Welcome to the world of photographer Fran Gardino. Actually, the world is seen through the lens of Fran Gardino. He's an artist constantly searching for that new insight, a different way of looking at things, a new angle. Always interesting. We'll talk about where he finds inspiration, how he goes about studying his subjects, and why he likes wabi-sabi. This is Norm Tebow. Let's move in and get a closer look at Fran Gardino. We're putting our first podcast together. Fran Gardino is here to talk about his work, and we wanted to ask him about how he finds his subjects, or if his subjects find him.
A combination of both, I would say. I kind of wander around just looking for different history and different interesting objects. Sometimes it's interesting designs. I just like to kind of investigate like a child, you know, like if you're wandering around the rocks, you know, on the beach and looking for the different animals and fishes and snails and things and see what you can find that you couldn't see from a distance, you know, kind of dig your way in and look close and just see what's there, you know, and instead of picking it up and bring it back to my parents, I just take a photograph of it, you know, and I try to save it that way. And then sometimes I'll just dig around old places that I used to hang around when I was a kid.
You could bring a whole wagon load of that stuff home. Fran, I don't need all these seashells.
Right.
Here's a picture, Mom. Does that work better?
Right. And I can store it on my little compact flash card. And I put it on my hard drive on my Mac, and then that's it. And I store it off on a DVD, and That's pretty much it. It's a lot simpler. And
is it easier to catalog that stuff?
Well, not really, object? Because I have a lot more of it. So I have it cataloged by date and by location.
Mm-hmm.
So generally, I have an idea of where it's going to be.
You've been getting this response online from folks who see your stuff on Google Earth, and you've gotten some nice comments, especially about
some of the panorama shots that I shoot of Boston. There's one in particular. I was up in the hills of East Boston. There's a Madonna statue, and it's kind of on the edge of a cliff. So what I did was I walked behind this statue, and you can actually see the whole panorama of the whole Boston skyline, but it also goes all the way over, you know, past the airport, and so you get a really, really wide view of the Boston skyline. And so I took this long panorama of individual shots. So I take like 50 shots of that particular spot I took. And in one of the shots, there was a bird. It was a seagull that was flying in, just flew through the shot. And so I left that in there when I stitched it together. And then I noticed, too, that there were some boats going in between the harbor and the airport. So what happened was I have this panorama, and this Chinese guy sent me an email. Or actually, he sent me a comment on the Google Earth website that said, "Oh, I love the use of the static and the moving," and he started writing all this stuff about how the tension between movement and no movement, and I was like, I didn't see that at all. I was just taking the shot, so it was kind of nice to get different comments.
Well, you're open to interpretation no matter what you do,
right? Yeah, it was.
You can't get inside their heads.
Yeah, I guess it's, you know, it's good to do that because you never know what you're going to get. Sometimes I see something and I'm not sure exactly why I like it, but fortunately, you know, you get comments from people and let you know. Oh yeah, that I guess that's why. I really liked that, having that bird in that shot. You know, it wasn't just because it was out of balance or something like that.
I heard somebody from Monty Python, I think it was Michael Palin, talking how they took heat for some of the subjects at the time. They didn't worry about being politically correct back then. He said, well, if something appealed to us and we thought it was funny, even though it might have been a sensitive subject, we felt, well, if we're laughing at it, we kind of rely on our intuition. We'll go with it, even though they took some heat for it.
Yeah.
Later.
Yeah, I found some places like that, too. I found some history on Everett because we wandered into a graveyard. It was a Revolutionary War graveyard a couple of weeks ago in Malden. I took a picture of one of the headstones which told who was in this graveyard. And I had all these names. And so I searched for some of the names, Googled the names that were in there, right? And I found out they were heroes from the war. And then I found out that, okay, that whole section of Everett there, and Malden, actually, that section of Everett was part of Malden at one time, up until about 1860. And Malden was actually named by the British, and it was before the Revolutionary War. And it was Maldin, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So then they said they were all these sheep. And there was that whole section there where it's all pollution and you know, distar gas and all this other stuff now. Edison Power Plant was all sheep there. And it was all fields. And actually, it was right across the Mystic River from Bunker Hill, which is where the British, you know, were. And the British kind of took over Bunker Hill in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And the Patriots still had the other side, the Everett side. So what happened was, I'm reading this history of Malden, and because it had one of the heroes from the cemetery in it, and it's given me this whole view of this of Everett that I had no clue that's the way it was at one time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I started thinking, you know, my mother has a house in Everett, and it was made by a guy named Captain Rich. I couldn't find him, but their house was pre-Revolutionary War house, so that house was there when the sheep were were down where the Edison plant is right now.
Mm-hmm.
So this morning I went for a little drive and to shoot photos, and I went right down there because I wanted to see. And so all of a sudden I'm looking out over all this industry and everything and pollution and pilings and things like that. And all I can see is sheep, you know, and these guys with these wooden ships and, you know, these battles, skirmishes happening between the British and these guys and families and people dying and things like that. And it was just a whole new kind of world to me down there. And I'm trying to shoot with that in mind,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then I noticed that there were pilings. They had periwinkles. And then there was the big Edison plant's smokestack. And then off to the distance was the Bunker Hill Monument. And so it's kind of like it all came together. You know? It's like here's this whole history going on in this spot, you know, and God knows what happened in that area. Probably all kinds of different battles and people having conversations and just, it must have just tremendous history. You know, the ghosts that are walking around there, Paul Revere, or, you know, George Washington, and, you know, all these guys, they were all up here where I grew up, where I used to wander around the dump. You know, that was the dump to me. But this was, you know, and I started thinking, I'm going to take another shot of that area because I've taken a lot of panoramas of the industries, refineries, you know, the power plant and all that. All I can think of is to title it The Sacrilege. What we did to this historic spot, the spot where this was really the birth of this. Because according to that book that I was reading, they said the British were not only taxing these guys, but they were also taking their sheep, and they were sending the sheep back to England. So not only did they try to make them poor, they also took their food away, too. So, and it was like, that was the last straw. And you can see these guys saying, wait, come on. We have to come up with another deal here. You know, we're not going to take this. And then that's when they got the guns, and they said, forget it, you know, and they amassed lots of people, and they everybody got it at the same time. Nobody had to build a coalition. It just happened. And you could see where they were just taking everybody and trying to get everything they could out of, you know, these poor people are trying to live a life, you know. They left to escape this, and then they were trying to recreate it over here. I don't think so. Why would they bother coming over here if it was going to be the same as it was over there? I find these old industrial areas, and some of them, they're not, the buildings are not there anymore, but there's trash is left over. So I think it's kind of funny to, you know, take a spot where it used to be this show place, but now it's not anymore. It's all derelict, you know, there's nothing going on. It's all,
mm-hmm.
you know, corroded and everything. And so to me, it's a great thing. I find out that the authorities of Everett don't necessarily like me taking pictures of the parts of the city that are down and out, you know. But to me, it's part of history, you know, and it's something I really like.
You have a particular affinity for the junkyard.
I do like the junkyards, yeah. So, or actually not junkyard per se, but there is one there, yeah.
You practically grew up in that junkyard.
Oh, yeah, I grew up. There was a dump actually down the street from where I lived. It's funny because they actually shot fireworks off there, too, when we were kids. And we lived on the second floor of a two-family. And people used to come over our house, and we would open the windows, and they would have a big party, and they would watch the fireworks from our window. But they were actually being shot in the dump.
you thought it was a junkyard, but it was really a dump.
It was a dump.
Because kids like junkyards.
Yeah, they like junkyards.
Because they can find things.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can find things in dumps, too.
Dumps, too. Okay.
Well, at the time, that's, you know, everything went in the dump. And so when it turns out, one of the favorite things I shoot is fireworks. I go down to Boston all the time. If I can get a good spot, I'll shoot them. And I happen to have been in Chicago once when the fireworks were being shot. And I set up, and I really spent a lot of time. And last year I was actually at the Boston Pops, and the guy from the Boston Herald was right next to me. And he forgot everything. He forgot his remote, shutter release cable, and, you know, a tripod. He had to borrow one, you know. And so I was all set up. I was ready to go because I had done one before, you know. And so I got some great shots. And at the end of the night, he didn't get any as good shots as I got. And I said, well, I'll sell you one. He said, no. You know, and so he took out his Mac and he emailed the one. And sure enough, he was on the front cover of the paper the next day. It wasn't as good as one of the ones I have, you know. So
yeah.
But, you know, what the heck.
So did you do panoramics then or just caught those images?
Of the fireworks?
Yeah.
No, because
you can't do this too
fast.
Yeah.
It's like a one-second exposure.
Right.
So if you try to move it, because they're moving too fast. So
you can't get them that fast.
Yeah. No. So actually, you have to try different speeds and different settings and everything because they're moving so fast, as you know. You know, even when you shoot your own, sometimes you'll get a good one, sometimes you won't. But I got to the point where I could get some different effects out of it. So I could really cut down on the light, so I could get just the streaks, or I could get the smoke if I wanted, or varying degrees of the streaks and the smoke. It was a little bit of a workout. But anyways, I thought that was interesting, the connection between that and the dump.
Yeah, because the fireworks started there. Your interest in fireworks, anyway. Let's get back to your fascination with panoramas.
Oh, okay.
You're really into panoramic shooting. Talk about that a little bit. How did you get started with it? What got you into it?
Well, I think the first time that I really got, someone mentioned it to me, was my father. I was at the Museum of Fine Arts. They had a show on John Singer Sargent. Mm-hmm. And he had this panorama painting of, I don't even know which war it was. I think it was the Spanish-American War. But there were some old soldiers coming back from the battle. And it was a long painting, maybe 20 or 30 feet long and about 10 feet high. And my father said to me, you should try one of those panoramas sometimes. He says, because they're a lot of fun. He says, they look harder than they are. And you get a nice balance and a rhythm to it when you get the people wandering through the scene, you know. And so what happened was I had heard about digital photography doing stitching and panoramas and everything. And right away I thought back to that, what my father was saying that time. And instead of doing people, I actually do it with trees and bushes and things. And I try to get that rhythm similar to like a group of people walking down, or maybe, you know, different stances on the stage, different characters. I just recently went to the ballet, and I was just really blown away by some of the, because a lot of them are really panoramic, and just the way that the dancers come in, and the way they go out, and the way the balances are, and the design of the whole thing, and the movement. And right now, with the bushes and the shrubs and the reeds and everything, I'm really looking at it that way. So I'm trying to catch a scene that's, you know, that's has some kind of a balance to it and rhythm.
The wabi-sabi?
Wabi-sabi, yeah. Wabi-sabi, the old stuff, because I like to just look at reeds and old trees and stuff that's deteriorating, you know. But then I also started doing some work on Google Earth, which is basically you try to capture a scene from a horizontal viewpoint as opposed to Google Earth, which is looking downward. So they're looking from a satellite, and they look down. So they're what they allow you to do is put a little link to a photo so that you can actually see it from the side as opposed to looking at that scene from the top.
Right.
So they have really good detail from the top, you know, not as good as a regular photo. But so what I try to do is I try to say, okay, well, now somebody wants to go to that spot. They want to know what it looks like when they're looking around. And it turns out panoramas are a really good tool on Google Earth because, you know, you go there, you want to be able, if you were to plop yourself down in that spot, the first thing you do would be turn your head and you'd look around like that, you know, not necessarily 360, but you'd give it a 180 anyways. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I try to
You're doing mostly 180s. Have you done
mostly
360s?
I've done 360s, but I haven't actually put them fully together.
Are you familiar with converting them with that kind of software?
I've never done the conversions. I have some that I've done, but I've never done it.
Now, when you do your panoramas,
yeah,
do you use a tripod?
I have, but not mostly the time I don't now because Photoshop is so good at it. And also, I'm getting pretty good at being like a human tripod. And because Photoshop will correct it for any little error.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that when you shoot, if you ever try to put a camera on a tripod and then get it to spin so that it was perpendicular with the horizon,
mm-hmm,
it's not that easy.
Oh.
So you can do it and you do a dry run, but very often the camera is going to kind of rotate a little bit or do one thing or another. But whereas if you do it manually as a human a tripod, you can actually take a part of the grid lines in the viewfinder and line them up with something on the horizon, mm-hmm, and then you can just move all around. And like I say, Photoshop is good enough. It'll fix, you know, some of these distortions that might happen if you happen to tilt a little bit one way or another. It's not perfect, but it kind of adds something to the scene, the fact that it's not a mechanical scene, the fact that it's a human, me scrolling across, you know, panning, or me tilting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's really very unmechanical. I've had some where there are trees that, you know, I'm doing a close-up view of a tree, branches and things, and some branches are in focus and some branches are not, and then it kind of goes in and out of it. So some branches are sometimes they're focused and sometimes they're not, and so what happens is it gets a very organic look to it. And I found that, you know, there's several photos that I have that way that work really well. So some of them don't work at all, but when they work, they really it's kind of like you can almost see the movement,
mm-hmm,
because you know, you see one stationary branch that's focused, and then there'll be some other ones around it that are not.
Cubism.
It's like cubism.
Different views.
Different views.
No. Well,
no, it's more like expressionism.
Oh,
if there's,
yeah,
such a thing as expressionist photography, that's kind of where it's going. And some of them, they even look like Jackson Pollocks or something like that. But they have a wabi-sabi look to them. Natural, you know, look of impermanence. The branches peeling and... not a lot of flowers, you know. I shoot some flowers, but not. It's generally it's in the fall, and from the fall to the just before the spring. So,
what are you working on right now?
Well, actually, I just got an artist pass to the Garden in the Woods in Framingham, and it was $50, and I get to go there for a whole year, and it's a garden in the woods, and so there's a lot of wild flowers. They want to promote the flowers that were here naturally, or originally, native,
mm-hmm,
native plants. So I went there once last week, and so I just joined this. So I'm kind of curious to see what happens to that location over the period of a year. So I don't know what's going to happen, you know, in the middle of the summer, what flowers should come out, this, you know, what happens in the fall and in the winter. I'm really kind of excited about going in there in the winter, see what's going on. But there are a group of people that really maintain the place, and they're trying to make it into a beautiful spot where people come in, like Monet's garden, you know, give her, although it's, mm-hmm, more of a natural type of thing. It's not man-made. That I'm working on that. And then I'm also working on some proposals for a variety of different outdoor events. So I'm working on one for First Night right now, which is the
First Night Boston.
First Night Boston, yep. It's the seasons, the four seasons in it. I don't know if it'll get accepted, but it's going to be big, tall panorama photos of the four seasons, one on each pillar in the new section of the Boston Public Library.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just kind of looking for ways to jazz up different locations. It's kind of fun. It's the first time I've ever thought about doing it at the Boston First Night. But they seem to be very open to everything. I've talked to a couple of people there, and they want it to be, you know, a festive type thing. They want it to deal with time. I saw a photo actually was an ad for a show that's going on in Quebec City. I was on a business trip in Halifax, and they have this event that's going on where they project these giant images on these silos, on these grain elevators in Quebec City. And they're, you know, I don't know how many feet high, 50, 100 feet high. And they have a giant projector, and they're going to project them onto these silos.
Didn't they used to do that in France, on the size of buildings?
Maybe.
And the music soundtrack was supplied by, I think, the guy that did Oxygen.
I don't know, but the guy's name is LePage that's doing this now.
I'm trying to think of the musician that they used to use the music of. He came from a soundtrack-type family.
It is a French company. I can say that because I looked it up, and I don't remember the name of them right now. But so I'm thinking, okay, well, why doesn't Boston do something like this? And I even put a proposal in for one of those, but she kind of blew me away. You know, she said, it's not going to happen. Yeah, so it's, you know, and so I'm going to do some research on it. But, I'm hoping to do this in Boston at some point, have these giant projection images on these buildings, and, you know, maybe it'll be wabi-sabi. But, you know, hey, you know, the world is ready for green stuff now, I think. So it's, you know, it can't be all bad, right?
Yeah. You got a lot of ideas, and I wish you luck. And we've got too many things to talk about, Fran. You've got too much on your mind, so we'll have to do another podcast.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay?
Yeah.
Thanks.
All right, thank you.
Well, that about wraps up our conversation with Fran. And by the way, that musician whose name I couldn't recall, the one whose work is often accompanied by the projection of colored light and images on skyscrapers and other buildings, that would be electronic musician Jean-Michel Jarret, son of famed movie composer Maurice Jarret. Jean-Michel had an international electronic dance hit in 1976 called Oxygen. Oh, wait a minute. We can't play that music here. Copyright laws and all that. This podcast is produced by me, Norm Tebow, at Hey Norm Productions. Copyright 2009 by Fran Gardino and Norm Tebow. But feel free to share this show with anyone you think might be interested. You can see images and find out more about Fran's work at www.frangardino.com.